Welcome to the Rearview Mirror Podcast, looking back on all that we don't know and a few things that we do. What's the most interesting feed? Are we on right now?
We are ready to roll if you're ready to roll. We're okay, recording.
Yeah. I guess
that means we're on.
Yeah. Overly caffeinated this morning, so I'll be asleep in 30 minutes. But what's the most interesting feedback you've got, unexpected feedback you've gotten so far?
On our...
Yeah.
You know, I think initially it was so much family and close friends. So it was just, you know, affirming, positive. That's great. The one that I got this past week, Laura and I were out for dinner with some friends, and he went on and on about your voice and how much he enjoys your voice.
Oh.
And that you've just got this great, soothing voice, great voice for listening to. And I thought, well, good for that. So that was interesting to me because I don't think about my voice or your voice. You know, I don't think about our voices, but it really jumped out to him.
Do you know, that's funny because the first podcast I did last year, the golf podcast.
Yeah, that's right.
I was so nervous, not because of the content. We talked for an hour and a half. I mean, I can shoot from the hip pretty good. I'm like, I don't know what I sound like. Uh-huh. And what I remember is back in the day, I lived in Memphis and I played for a little exhibition basketball team. We traveled around and played. But in the off season, we did all kinds of stuff. Well, long story short, I met a guy in Memphis named Dana Kirk. Well, Dana Kirk was the coach for the Memphis Tigers for a long when it was Memphis State.
Yes.
So we worked out at the same gym. We got to be friends because of what I did. And he had me on his radio show a couple of times.
That's
to
amazing.
Talk about SEC basketball. I'd kind of forgotten about this. Well, back then we were on AM radio. So Jen and I were dating or engaged at this point. So she's working in Little Rock and I'm living in Memphis, working there. And I said, hey, I'm on a radio show. It's going to air tonight at 7 o'clock to preview, I don't know, Ole Miss and somebody playing basketball. Yeah. And she, and I probably did, she said, you sounded beyond Southern. Like,
really?
Like, just
thick.
She said, yeah, it was, she said it was really good, but in her nice way, she said it was really twangy.
Yeah.
And so that's what I thought when I listened to this podcast from last summer, I thought, man, but then when I listened to it, I thought, yeah, you can definitely tell I'm from the South. But right. It didn't sound as bad as I thought. And I thought, does anybody really know what they sound like?
I don't think so. I don't know
how that works. I'd love to have somebody on that can talk about that, about the sonic part of that and how you, what you think you sound like versus what you, I mean, when I sing in the car, I think it sounds great. And, you know, when I heard it recorded one time, it was abysmal.
That's less than great.
It's less than great.
It's funny you're saying that. We sent a bunch of videotapes and stuff in to get them digitized recently. So I'm going through all these boxes of stuff I've kept through the years. I found a cassette tape of me speaking at my high school graduation, 1977.
East Tennessee.
Oh my gosh. And then some, and I still have words that come out so Southern, you know, there's
like what?
T E N and T I N. They sound the same. H E L L and H A I L and H A L E. They're all hell to me. I mean, it's like, I'm from Tennessee, but you know, it's so feel. But my enunciation is perfect today, relatively speaking, to that high school boy that was speaking then. You know,
both my daughter and my wife said you enunciate better than I do.
Oh,
I get a little lazy with that.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I feel like I can be,
and I'm really lazy working on it too. So
good.
No, not at all.
I knew that.
If we get a sponsorship and somebody really wants to pay us and, you know,
then
wants
me, set up
and part of the contract is that I enunciate better. Yeah, I'll sit up straight. I won't slouch in my chair and I'll stop drinking coffee during the middle and I'll enunciate better.
That's who you are.
Until that point, we're going
to just keep muttering our words together.
All right. So we're going to do something a little different today.
Okay. I'm excited. I love that you bring these thoughts.
We're going to talk about, we've threatened to do this before. And one friend of mine told me a couple of days ago, he said, my gosh, would y'all just do this? You've talked about it every episode.
Must be an Enneagram.
He loves it. It's the Enneagram. Yeah. He loves it. And so there's an enormous amount of information out there on this particular, the Enneagram, for those of you who don't know, it's just a personality test. Mm-hmm. And it's not even really a personality test. It's more of a personality tool that just indicates tendencies. But it's pretty robust and it has a lot of applications, pretty easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, our plan is to do this in two parts.
Okay.
Just kind of an overview today.
Yep.
And what I thought we'd do is, since you do this professionally, I mean, you meet with groups, teach the Enneagram, talk to them about
enjoy
it,
that.
And you're really good at it. So I thought, let's go through just a basic overview of it.
Okay.
And then I'll give a little bit of a layman's interpretation of it.
Well, that'd be perfect.
And then you go through there are nine numbers that indicate personality types.
Yep.
And then I'll give a layman's version of kind of what I know. I dabble in it. I know just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah.
And I love reading about it.
But yeah.
I don't have the extensive knowledge that you do.
Yeah.
But I'll give an application or a layman's version.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, all right.
I love that. I love that.
Overview.
Well, I think you did a great overview just then.
Thanks.
The Enneagram really is another personality tool that helps us look at nine different ways of how we see the world, and it impacts everything from our strengths, our weaknesses, our preferences, our motivations, our fears. I think the thing about the Enneagram that has always been so helpful for me is you use this word, it's the word I love, robust. I think it's more robust than some of the other tools. I've always been a personality tool junkie, Steve. You know, I've loved the Myers-Briggs, the DISC, growing up with those. And I think they're super valuable and they can be really helpful in certain contexts. The Enneagram, I feel like, takes those and it expands on them in some really cool ways to help us say, okay, what are my strengths, my weaknesses, my desires, my preferences, and just kind of how I approach life.
Yeah.
So when we look at the Enneagram, I think it's the reason I love people doing it is, again, I think it's a self-awareness tool. You know, at the end of the day, it just helps me go, gosh, I want to understand why do I always do that? Or why does that motivate me? Or why is my first blush always go, oh my goodness, what else might happen here? You know, because different types respond different ways.
Yeah.
I think the other thing I think about as we start to talk about it is, like any personality tool, the big warning, the big yellow flashing light, the big danger is don't try to put yourself into one box. You know, it's really easy. And I hear people say this all the time. And I'll say it. It rolls right off my tongue. Oh, I'm an Enneagram 3. Well, no, sort of. I mean, but I'm so much more than just a 3. Matter of fact, when I do corporate training or even when Laura and I will do the Enneagram at a marriage event, generally speaking, our topic for the Enneagram is, we use this phrase that we've been using for almost 20 years now, more than a number. The Enneagram, it's more than just a number, because I think we get so locked on, oh, I'm a 7. Oh, then I know exactly what you are. Instead of being able to go, gosh, in the true Enneagram, at any given moment, we're interacting with 3, 4, 5 numbers at any given moment at some level. But preferentially, there's one number that usually we identify with most clearly. And so when we do say, I'm a 7 or I'm a 3 or I'm a 4, okay, what we're really saying is that's what comes out of me most when you're around me. And so, again, I think it's a great way of growing self-awareness. And then candidly, in relationships, you and I as friends, it's good that, you can understand, well, Jeff's tendency is going to be this and your tendency is going to be that. It helps us appreciate the differences instead of getting so dadgum frustrated that you don't think the same way I do or you don't see the world the same way I do.
That's where I think I was surprised at, and I would encourage folks, especially if you're younger, just to listen to this through the context and lens of the work world.
Yeah.
It's helpful relationally in the work world. It's helpful relationally with marriage and kids.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think that component of it is more, I think we probably understand our spouses a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We're always understanding them better, but I think we understand our spouses and our kids. This can obviously help, but a lot of the challenge there is willingness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you willing to change? Are you willing to adapt? Sometimes in the work world, I think we don't apply the same rationale as we do in our other relationships. Okay, this person's, they're using terms. They're using the term data all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so what does that tell you? It tells you their tendency is probably Enneagram 1, 5, mm-hmm, something that you'll get into in a minute. But I think it's been really helpful understanding how other people that I work with are wired. And then in turn, what information do they need or what do they need?
Yeah. And not just what, but how they need it, right? Some people want it long and flowery and drawn out. That's not wrong. Others are like, get me to the point and get out of my office. Again, it's just different wirings.
Man, I have a friend. He passed away a few years ago, but he was one of the brilliant thinkers that I've ever known.
Wow.
He was just an unbelievable strategist, executive with a company high up. But he managed as probably an Enneagram 8. Again, that you'll get into. And his motto for the people that reported to him was be brief, be bright, and be gone.
Be brief, bright, and gone. I've never heard that. That's brilliant.
It's but great. That's but that's the way he, and he was a caring guy. It wasn't that he's uncaring, but his point was, hey, when we meet, I'm going to be respectful of your time and you be respectful of mine. Have your stuff together.
Yeah.
And it's not your, this is not a forum that's carte blanche for you to just spit out everything that you've thought about over the past few weeks. We're going to talk about these topics and stay on task. And, and that's just the way you manage. Yeah. And that was great.
Yeah. And I tell you, when you're sitting around a boardroom table, you better know that you've got probably all nine or at least a lot of these types around there. And so if you're facilitating, how you facilitate a conversation, I think it's one of the greatest challenges in the world. And I think this is where the Enneagram can help you realize, I can read this room right now and know we need to be brief. We need to be bold. We need to get to some points moving on. But other times we've also got to be able to let those that are so driven say, hey, I'm going to need all of us just to slow down a minute. We need to process this a little bit. And, you know, you'll see some of the types almost like, oh gosh, process.
Yeah.
But for the other types, you'll see them lean in. And if you can bounce between those places, you get the best out of the room in those moments.
And agreed. And even to the point, I think, of if you work for a bigger company, or what personality types are drawn to a bigger company, to the, you know, the security of that, the predictability of that. Mm-hmm. If you know that and can understand it a little bit, you can react accordingly. Yeah. If you're with a smaller company or an entrepreneur, you're going to react differently. And, you know, I've conversations with younger guys a lot that own their own businesses or that are in my industry, and you know, each one of them needs a different thing.
Yeah.
And they like they value different things and they're motivated by different things. And you're not all motivated by getting the job done or making money. There are other factors. And so and I think you can learn, hey man, it's challenging. If I'm a Enneagram whatever and I own my own business, I'm gonna have some real challenges.
Right.
I may need to hire or partner up with a blank, you know? And so anyway.
There are types that complement each other really well.
Yes.
And there's types that easily go to conflict really fast. Again, it doesn't mean they can't work together. Someone asked me years ago, hey, what two types work best in marriage? It's like, you know, give me this number and this number. And my answer was simply, oh, any two numbers, as long as those numbers are healthy. Because the reality is any two numbers can relate well. But if I'm not healthy in my number, if the ugly part of me comes out frequently,
it doesn't matter.
If we're the exact same number, we're still going to be in conflict a whole lot. But but it's a great way of understanding my inner world, understanding how I react to others in the broader world as well.
All right. Let's walk through it. Yeah.
Okay. So again, the numbers, you know, we talk about the Enneagram 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera, all the way up to 9. But then with each of them, there's a word or different 2, 3 words that are connected to them that's kind of like, hey, here's, I'm an Enneagram 1. I'm the reformer. Like in the READY, one of the big Enneagram tests that's out there online, RHETI, if you ever want to look at it, they call the 1 the reformer. Other groups call the good person or the moral person. You know, the Enneagram 1s, their basic desire is to be virtuous, to be right, to be good. They really want to be correct. At their extreme, they can be perfectionists. That's where they have to be careful. They can cross over that line. For the Enneagram 1, though, you know, the thing that's so beautiful about the 1 is that they walk into something and they're like the constant improvement something. They would come into an office and they would go, oh, and this is really good. But have you ever thought about putting that chair over there? Because you can walk through the room a little bit better. Kind of their focus question is like what's wrong and what needs to be corrected right now. They love to improve. It's a beautiful part of who they are. When I think about the 1, you know, they're these really principled, good reformers. And with every type, maybe we'll do this really quick. We'll talk about them at their best. Those are good words for the 1. Principled, reformers, good, change agents. They love to see things get better. But, you know,
Including themselves.
Oh.
Constant quest for improvement of themselves is what I've noticed.
I love that you said that. You know, it reminds me that the Enneagram 1 has something that nobody else has, and it's called the inner critic. The inner critic is like this voice, not pathological or anything, but this internal voice that's saying, could have been better. You didn't do that good enough. And I remember studying this, you know, 25 years ago and learning all about the inner critic, and, you know, logically it kind of made sense, but I thought, I'm not sure that's really true about those guys. I'm teaching a conference once And I get to this point and I'm talking about the Enneagram One. And the Enneagram One, unlike the other types, has something called an inner critic. It's this voice that will often give them feedback that's like, well, you could have done better. Don't you do that? And literally on the front row, honest to goodness, this lady raises her hand and I acknowledge her. She stands up and she looks around the room. And she goes, wait, don't all of you have that? And I thought, she's definitely a one.
Right.
But it was just, it's a different part of them. You know, so there's the beauty. There's the strength. Change agent. Let me make it better. How do I improve? When taken to an excess, which is what happens with any of our strengths, if we use it too much, it becomes a weakness. Or in the Enneagram world, we'll often talk about the shadow side of the one. Mm-hmm. And for the one, man, when they get to that place, they can become the perfectionistic, legalistic. There's a sense of being controlling.
Critical,
non-resilient. So that's just a good little snapshot of the Enneagram one. A great example of the one, though, because I really want people to see the beautiful part of the one. Think Mahatma Gandhi. Think Gandhi, you know, and what he did. Think, Nelson Mandela. You know, these people who are reformers that looked at a situation and said, this isn't good. How do we make it better?
High justice.
Beautiful sense of justice. Absolutely.
What I've found, I have a lot of Enneagram One friends, and some of my best conversations happen with them. And it's really interesting. They're willing to dive deep. What I've noticed about them just practically, particularly in the work setting, is a lot of information. Yeah. They both enjoy a lot of information and they give a lot of information. And so I think, again, in any setting, and even if that's your spouse or your kid, you just have to know if there are 10 things in a one's head that are relevant to the particular conversation you're having,
yes,
they want to get all 10 out. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to stop at 7. They don't want to stop at 8. They want all 10 to be out there. And you, so we'll get to yours, but you are an Enneagram 7 that in stress goes to 1. Mm-hmm. Not stress like you're having anxiety or freaking out, just any kind of pressure or stress.
Right.
You like a lot of information.
I can get into the details. Absolutely.
Yes. So.
Yeah.
But again, I've had a business partner that was 1 and it was great. And they're willing to dive into things to a depth that a lot of people aren't willing to dive into them at.
Yeah. They will make things better.
Yes.
I love that about them.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Good.
Okay. Enneagram 2, the helper, the lover, the caring person. You know, when I think about the twos, the first thing I always think is I think, man, if I'm ever in the hospital one day and I've got some kind of terrible pain going on, I want an Enneagram 2 to be my nurse.
Really?
You know, oh, yeah. That's just going to be caring and loving. And, oh, you need more morphine here, Mr. Jeff. You can have more, you know. But, you know, the two, their desire is to be helpful, to be needed, to be purposeful. You know, their big question they're constantly asking is, you know, where can I serve? You know, who needs something? Who is there out there that I might be able to be value added to? Again, at their best, you can hear it in the two. They are the people that they love to serve. They care about others. You know, they're the people that are going to show up when they hear that, you know, something's going on in your life. They're going to go, can I bring a meal? Can I help out? Can I mow your grass? You know, they want to tangibly do something that helps improve your life. They're, you know, again, you love having them around you.
Motivated by what?
I think a lot of the motivation for them is can be their need to be needed. This is where the two has to be careful. Well, okay. Like every type, by the way, every type has something.
Right.
So their motivation is often, man, I really want to be needed, and not necessarily in an ugly way. Again, it can be a very healthy way. I've got these gifts and I want to use them so that I can improve you, but that motivation can be in there.
So let me ask you this. So if, let's say the two sees a need, meets the need, and is not acknowledged.
Yeah. So a healthy,
what happens?
So that's a great question. And I think this is what sets us up between the healthy side and the unhealthy side, or the shadow side, as we said a minute ago. A healthy two meets the need, is not acknowledged, and they're just like, man, I'm so glad I got to help them. There's so much going on in their life. They probably can't even think to say thank you. Or they may even be at the place where they go, man, I did what I do. I served. I'm great. And they just move on.
Right.
They don't need anything. Yeah. They don't need anything. But when the two gets unhealthy, when the two's, and the biggest way the two gets unhealthy is they serve everybody except themselves. I'll take care of you. I'll take care of you. I'll take care of you. But, oh, I forgot to take care of me. And so when twos get to that place of unhealth, they've served, they've loved, they've helped so much, they become you know, they start functioning like people pleasers, or they're very enmeshed at the extreme. They can come kind of codependent. And then what grows in them is a sense of resentment, a sense of bitterness, a sense of like, well, I did that for you. Why didn't you do anything for me? But they're too nice to probably ever say that. But on the inside, there's really this sense of, well, I can't believe they didn't do that back for me.
Yeah.
I grew up in the South. I grew up with some Southern aunts and grandma who were very much those.
And everybody appears to be a two in the South.
Oh, yeah, especially in the church world, you know,
right.
on potluck Sunday.
Right.
But I think, again, the shadow side of us often lets us know what I really am, is that, man, there is something in me that feels resentful when I serve others. What's that about? Ooh, this is where I need to be needed, is getting out of balance.
So what's a good indicator for the two when you're, if someone's listening in their own, man, I think that's me, and I did some things for someone, didn't get acknowledged, or, excuse me, what's a good indicator that I'm headed toward my unhealthy side?
Yeah. I think it is. I think it's just that slow burn of feel like I'm almost obsessing about what I did.
The reaction.
Why didn't they notice?
Okay.
You know, why didn't Steve thank me for that a little bit more? You know, or
No. Thanks, Jeff. No, oh, it's too late now.
I think that's something just to be attentive to, is going, okay, wait a minute. Am I looking for kudos back more than just being able to be my true self and say, gosh, I love to serve. I love to love. I love to care. I love to help.
So I think about a couple of twos that I had a stint a few years ago where I worked for a bigger company for a year and a half, 2 years. And it was a good experience and for the most part. But getting settled in to a larger group was tough. There were a lot of mechanics things that I didn't know how to do and never done.
Yep.
Didn't really care about.
Yep.
But I found some Enneagram twos in the office and they were really helpful.
Yeah.
And I found that just some acknowledgement of that.
Yes.
Yep. If you've got twos around you, man, what a great, these folks saved me an enormous amount of time. They were sweet about it. And just a thank you or a lunch or hey, I really appreciate, it doesn't take a lot.
Yeah.
Right. It's been my experience.
Well, and I think, remember the old Gary Chapman 5 love languages. I think a lot of twos respond well when we can offer them words of affirmation.
Yeah.
Just like you were saying, sometimes it's as simple as a thank you or gosh, when you did that, that really was a help to me, or I appreciate you coming alongside of me. I think for most twos that can fill their cup up pretty big, pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Enneagram 3, the achiever, the achiever, the effective, the successful, the pragmatic. I mean, we have so many names for the three, but they love to get stuff done. I'll say about the threes, the threes have a to-do list about their to-do list. Like they have so many to-do lists to get things done. It's interesting, Steve, in the Enneagram world, every time I've taken tests over the years, I've always tested as a three. My second score right underneath it has been the 7. And I never understood that because I think I identify so much with that 7 side of adventure and what can be next and what can be fun. We'll talk about the 7 a little bit, right? The fun is my word, as you and I've talked about. But I do, I think the shadow really knows, is what I say. The dark side of us shows me what's most foundational in me. And I think what I've come to believe is that most foundationally, I am a 3 because of the shadow sides that we'll talk about in just a second.
Okay.
I just see that in me. But in the old language, we used to talk about that people can be like this combo, like a 7-ish 3 or an 8-ish 3. And that's what I realized. Most people who meet me outside of me performing or in the professional world, they'll go, oh, Jeff's definitely a 7. It's always a joke. It's fun. What can we do next? But when I'm in that work mode, the 3 in me comes out. And I say that because I think it's good as we're thinking about our types to realize that there's this type of who we really are most foundationally that we've got to search to find. But there's sometimes for some of us, there's an adapted style. There's a certain way I have to function to do my work. And so
right.
I think that's a lot of who I've been in my life.
So when this came out, I didn't know a lot of that about you.
Mm-hmm.
We've called this podcast from Panera to our conversations at Panera to a podcast.
Yeah.
But it's totally different as we get into it.
Yeah.
A lot of it is conversational here, but it's, obviously it's much more filtered.
Right.
And, but there was something that came out. So talk about how the podcast was different for you from the conversation at Panera related to your 3-ness.
Yeah. It's, the 3's basic desire is to achieve, to accomplish, to be effective, ultimately to win. You know, favorite right. song of three, all I do is win, win. Yeah. win. You know, it's a, and so for me, I think what comes out in me when we start talking about doing this, and I'm going, oh gosh, there are people out there that are going to be listening to us.
Are there?
Well, there's like three, but you know, your wife, my wife, and I think your daughter. No, 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 but you know, but I think something in me started getting activated. This is the threeness in me. The seven would be, man, let's do this, Steve. It's going to be fun.
Right.
And that shows up, but the threeness in me is going, well, there's going to be people listening. We've got to be good. We've got to make this helpful for them. We've got to have the content that we can deliver that's good. And, you know, we talked about this on our very first, right. first episode.
Yeah.
And I think when I'm at Panera, I don't feel a need at all that I've got to be effective or accomplish anything. It's just like, you know, me, you, and me, you, and some other guys talking.
Yeah.
And so the threeness in me, that's the shadow side of the three. You know, for the three, again, think about the good side of the three for a second. Success-oriented, accomplishment-oriented, goal-oriented, adaptable. They want to excel. They get things done. You know, that's the great thing about the three. But again, used to an excess, it becomes the non-resourceful side or the shadow side. And then it becomes about being driven, being image-oriented, at their worst, becoming manipulative and superficial. In other words, if I don't know what I'm doing, then I'm going to make it look like I know what I'm doing. That's the image part of it. Image is everything, that commercial. Gosh, that's can be the mantra of the unhealthy three. So to your question, when we start talking about doing this on the podcast, that shadow side of me comes out going, oh my gosh, we got to make sure we're doing the right image. This has got to be good. People yeah. have got to really like me. They've got to like us. They've got to like what we're doing. Yeah. And, you know, I'm older now. I feel like I can see that more quickly. And I got a guy like you in my life who says, I see that in you. Cut it out. I can walk that back a lot of the times. But to say it's not there would be the biggest lie in the world. It can yeah. still percolate up. I want to make sure this is effective.
I think that, and I think we do want that. We want, you know, our hope is that this is helpful sure, to sure. folks, you know. The problem that we talked about that we both acknowledged is, all right, how do you measure that and how do you define it?
Right.
Because if you can't define what's good and helpful, which you really never will be able to.
Not fully.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you can take the preponderance of feedback and go, all right, well, this seems to be mm-hmm. good and right. But again, mm-hmm. on the unhealthy side, and I can wing to the three too. Mm-hmm. That's another term we'll get into in a minute. But yep. it's really hard for the three to know when they've been successful. So they're constantly mm-hmm. in that quest.
Well,
and combine that with the image part of that, you know, there are sayings in the counseling world that, you know, vulnerability can lead to creativity. Mm-hmm. And the threes, in my experience, have been some of the least, they're the hardest to get to be vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, threes are very unaware of what they're feeling emotionally. Mm. So if you don't know what you're feeling emotionally, it's really hard to be vulnerable with it. Plus, what you said a second ago, the three accomplishes a goal. Well, all that means is, okay, what's the next goal to yeah. accomplish, right? And so it's hard for the three sometimes to slow down and just really be present with, man, that was good.
Yeah.
Period. Yeah. You know, I don't have to move rapidly to the next thing. But again, efficiency, effectiveness, let's get it done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think of Tony Robbins. Think of Michael Jordan. You know, those are some of the stereotypical classic examples of the Enneagram three.
Yeah, and if you're riding along with them and you're an accomplishment person, they're going to take you places you probably can't go by yourself. Mm-hmm. Incredible mm-hmm. DNA and drive to accomplish.
Yeah,
it also can be, you know, it can be exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Both and
yeah,
right,
like
right.
every number.
Right, right.
All
right. Okay.
Good.
Enneagram four. I feel like I should just shut up and say, "Go, Steve. Tell us about it."
I'm gonna start right now.
Okay. Nothing but silence. The Enneagram four we call the individualist, the original, the introspective. Fours, their question they're asking constantly in their life is, hey, what's missing? What can I do that's going to be unique right now? The basic desire of that four is to be themselves. They still desire to be significant, but that word unique is a great four word, I think.
It is.
You know, it's like there's a drumbeat I march to, and I'm not sure that anybody else in the world can hear mine. Because my identity, I don't want to be put into a box. Fours want to feel special and valued in their greatest fears. I don't want to be ordinary. I don't want to be like everybody else.
Oh, man.
To speak to that.
No.
Out of your world.
That may be a totally different podcast because I may need the whole hour. That's true. it's energizing and exhausting.
What a great way to say it.
At the same time.
Yeah.
you know, and my poor wife, who you'll get to in a minute, she's an Enneagram 6, which is similar to the 2, mm-hmm. but she is a lover, supporter. But the 6, maybe the 2 also love hierarchy, mm-hmm. predictability, mm-hmm. tradition.
That's more the 6 right there.
The yeah, group, yep. you know, yep. and I am, you know, I'm okay with the group and some traditions, mm-hmm. but, you know, the biggest question I ask in every setting, whether it's work, personal, is why?
Yeah.
Why are we doing this? Why is this? And then some, you know, I think I bring some value to my company and my group, other groups I've been with, by looking at things differently.
Yes.
Again, I've talked about this before. I coached football a few years ago for probably 8 or 9 years at a local high school as a volunteer, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but I played basketball. I didn't play football, mm-hmm. but I love the challenge of it. I love the game. I love the, it's like chess. There's yeah. so many moving parts, but you know, I realized pretty quickly that, you know, it's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. You know, the defensive side is trying to restrict space. The offensive side is trying to expand space.
Yeah, that's great. That's
so
great.
You start yeah. there and you work backwards and just a fresh set of eyes.
Yeah.
But I'd say the 4 probably as much as any number needs others around them to help take those ideas and put them into action. We can mm-hmm. just get stuck in the idea of dream world mm-hmm. and never, mm-hmm. never take any action on it. So, mm-hmm. And having to be different all the time is exhausting. And yeah. I think I'm at a stage of life where I'm better with a group mm-hmm. and I'm better just kind of going along. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I can do for my wife is if she wants to do something and I'm maybe not super excited about it, I can mm-hmm. just say, yeah, let's do that. Okay.
Yeah.
And be okay with
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, and,
But see, again, the 4 at their best, they've got this original, authentic, expressive, creative side of them, right? And creativity comes in a zillion shapes and size.
Yeah.
You know, I used to joke, you know, East Nashville is filled with Enneagram 4s because that's where a lot of people who are trying to get their music gig
right.
are. And I think there's probably some truth
it's
in
true,
that,
yeah.
right? But it's not just music and art. There's so much ways that the creativity and the expressiveness of the 4 can come out. But you were kind of tipping your hand toward it and speak to this, you know, when the 4 goes to their shadow side, when the 4 starts to get a little bit unhealthy, less resourceful, the 4 has a bent toward becoming self-absorbed, moody, at the extreme, they'll start being withdrawn, hypersensitive, and even they can become very melancholy. Well, that's a word that's often used about the 4.
I'm sorry, I checked out. I wasn't interested in what you were saying. So what did you say?
Well, okay, let's go into the 5 because yeah. we just proved that. No, yeah. no, but those words, like the moodiness, the self-absorption, the melancholy, the oh no.
Totally true.
Yeah.
Totally true. And, you know, sometimes I'll have conversations with guys, friends of mine, guys I play golf with, and I'll say I'm an introvert, I think, in my nature. Oh, no, really? And yeah. Just recharge. I recharge alone, typically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's easy. It's easy for me to go from recharging to withdrawn and moody. And I can live in melancholy for a long time.
Yeah,
I can listen to music that's melancholy. You know, and
yeah.
there comes a point where you got to get out of that.
You almost like it when you get there.
It's
times.
A comfort. It's yeah. a comfortable place.
Yeah,
and I've studied the Enneagram long enough to know that. That's okay for a while.
Yeah.
But then I need to re-enter the world mm-hmm. and live in reality.
Yeah.
Cause man, I can be a narcissistic jackass sometimes, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that and knowing I'm headed that way, hey, you know,
how can I correct?
Let's get out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get back in the right lane.
You know, it's interesting. The 4s can be the most emotional and most, when healthy, most emotionally and empathic on the entire Enneagram. Mm. It's powerful about them, their ability. The challenge, like every one of the 9 types, is, okay, you can emote as a 4, but do you understand the emotion? Do you understand what it's doing for you, where it's helping you, where it's not helping you? But there's something beautiful about a 4 as they, when they are able to go, okay, I'm headed down that road a little too far. How do I pull back and remain engaged?
And one of the things I think is, that's a great point, because I don't mind having the deepest of conversations about the ugliest of issues yeah. with friends.
Absolutely.
And I can understand and have some level of empathy. I typically don't wear it though.
Right.
It doesn't become my burden right. like some of the other numbers.
Yeah.
And so some of that's good.
Mm-hmm.
some of that's, you know, maybe not good, but it's hard to do that with myself.
Well, I've seen you. You know, we've been in enough situations through the years. I've seen that side of you that can come out when someone's sharing something that's really hard, or that, or that, or that's been crisis like, or that's not going well for them. And you know, you're probably not going to tear up. You know, you're probably not going to reach across the table and hold her hand or hug them. But you are going to have some phrase that brings incredible comfort to people in those moments. And I think it's that ability sometimes to go, you know, it can be. It's usually very creative and original, very four-like. But I remember one specific time when you just looked across the table at one of the guys and you were just nodding your head. You didn't say a thing. And then a smile came across your face. And then you just said, I don't remember the exact words, but it's basically this. You said, and all that you shared just then, that doesn't define you. And I remember for that guy, it was just like, oh gosh, I've just told you my butt ugly. And now you're telling me that doesn't define me. But again, that's the compassionate side of the four when healthy.
Yeah. And again, when every part of your personality or number is healthy, you can kind of shine, and there's a creativity there, and there's creativity in a lot of the numbers, really. But yeah,
it's fun.
That's enough about the four.
Oh, I love it. I love it. The Enneagram 5, the investigator, the cerebral, the wise, we call them. I jokingly say this about the fives, but it illustrates how much they love knowledge. And the five's two favorite place in the world is a Google search bar and the library. In other words, they love to synthesize data. They love to know. They love to gain knowledge. Kind of one of their core questions is, well, does that make sense? Or what makes sense? Let me get more research on that.
Yeah.
You know, the fives, they're driven by a desire to be capable, to be competent, to be in the know. You know, they don't want to walk into a situation where they don't know. They want to know. And again, we need the fives. My gosh, they've got those brilliant minds. Think Albert Einstein, think Bill Gates. You know, these are people that we generally think, gosh, they seem like they were fives, or they are fives. And so what they bring to us that's so beautiful out of them is they're perceptive, they're innovative, they're knowledgeable, they're thoughtful. And I love the word about fives. They're synthesizers. They can bring in all this information and pull it together. You're sitting around the boardroom table. The five is often going to be a little bit, not always, but often going to be a little bit more quiet. They're going to be really listening. But it's that old, this will date us, but it is the Rearview Mirror podcast anyway. Mm-hmm. It's the old E.F. Hutton commercial. When an Enneagram 5 speaks, people listen.
Yeah.
Because they have thought through so much in the room.
And they don't use their words to such an extent that it's lost.
Exactly.
There are others that use so many words, you get lost. Exactly. And so they're very conservative with what they choose to say.
Well, even when you say conservative, one of the things about the Enneagram 5 is they work hard to conserve energy. Mm. Now, that people give them a bum rap. Oh, they're lazy. It's so not about laziness.
I've not experienced that.
Not at all. But there really is this sense of going, well, if I don't need to know that, why would I spend energy doing that? They can really compartmentalize in a, I think in many ways, a healthy way.
So if you're managing, if you're in the work world, or if you have a teenager that's an Enneagram 5, how do you manage them?
Well, a lot of that obviously depends on your type coming to them, right? And because that's going to impact
what do they need? But let me ask it that way.
Perfect question. The first thing you've got to be willing to do is understand that they are not the same as you, more than likely. They're different. And so, you know, I think, you know, again, it's always a fine line when we're talking about children. You know, most of the literature would say that, gosh, we don't even want to talk about a type on a child until they're like 20 or older. The problem is by the time they're 4 or 5, you're starting to see inclinations.
You kind of know.
Boy, that looks like my kid maybe. And I think that's good for us to know. We just don't want to put a label on a young child, right? But when we know we have a child, or as you said, or working with an employee who's a 5, their greatest fear is being useless, or being underprepared, or that sense of being overwhelmed. And so one of the greatest things we do if we're dealing with a 5 is we give them space to do what they do, to process. So my personality wiring with a 5, especially if I had to parent one, I would have not been very good at all at that, I don't think, because I would have so much content and data, I would have overwhelmed them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But fives, if we can realize, okay, what do I really want them to know? How do I affirm what they already do know? And how can I empower them to go know more? when we do that, we're acknowledging that. So, you know, I think approaching the five, there's something really valuable about being able to go, hey, I know this is an area that you have some competency in, but I'm really curious about this. Do you know more or do you need some time to respond? And many fives will go, let me get back to you on that. Because in their mind, they're synthesizing.
I love your word space, mm-hmm. because I think when I think about managing a five or the fives I've worked with before,
yes,
man, you could get some incredible data or data too, but you can get an incredible contribution from a five, or you can put the flame out so quickly. And the two words that come to mind are space and specificity.
Oh, that's a great second word.
So give them a specific task or tell them, hey, this is what I'm looking for. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. can you help me with this?
Mm-hmm.
Is this in your wheelhouse?
Yeah.
Yes. And then give them the space to do it and the time to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's my experience has been with fives and ones, it's tough to get them to react in chaos and in a short time frame.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so if you're managing them, just think of not helpful, just it's helpful for, I think, for your business and for your company. If you're managing a five, just to let them kind of do their thing,
right.
but give them some parameters of what you need.
Right. Right.
You know?
Yep. Again, knowledge is power in the five world.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right.
Enneagram six. Let's jump to those guys.
Let's do it.
Okay. Miss Jen, your wife. So you can weigh in strong on this one.
Oh man.
The sixes.
Sixes are great.
They are. The six, they're the loyalist. You know, you said earlier they're similar to the two. They're often mistyped and misidentified. There's so much similarity about them, but there are some unique differences. And for the six, you know, their words are, loyalty, committed, security. You used the word earlier, tradition. You know, they love knowing traditions. For the six, their basic desire is to feel secure, to belong, and to be supportive. You know, the six, their kind of focus question is, do we have everything you need to do? You know, what could possibly go wrong here? You know, I always say sixes are like Boy Scouts. You know, Jacob, our middle son, is an Enneagram six. And,
yes.
again, you can't type your kid when they're young, but I remember seeing in him when he was 5, 6, 7 years old, many Saturday mornings we'd get up and we'd take the little wagon and maybe him and some of the other siblings, and we would go for a nature walk. You know, we're in a neighborhood, but you know, you'd usually find a bunny, a squirrel, birds, you know, worms. And so we'd go for this nature walk just to get out of the house for a little bit. But before we could go, Jacob, and it took me a long time to realize what he was doing, Jacob would disappear for a minute. And then when he would come down, back in the day, he would always wear these little cargo shorts. So cute on a little boy back in those days, right? He would have a water bottle, a flashlight, and a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Because in his mind, he was thinking ahead. He was prepared for if something happens. And so, you know, the old be prepared motto of the Boy Scouts, sixes are that way. They love safety. They love security. But they also want to anticipate, man, could something go wrong? Sixes can think about, we use this phrase with them a lot, they can think about the worst case scenario.
You know,
at their extreme, they can get caught in that. And if they're not careful, this is where their non-resourceful side comes out. They can be very fearful. They can be very anxious. They can be locked on. Oh, yeah, but what if, but what if, but what if? Thousands of questions. Again, we're talking about the healthy side first. The healthy part of them, they're engaging. They're responsible. They're reliable. They're traditional. Generally, sixes are just delightful to be around when
right.
they're helpful. And again, speak to that because you see it every day.
Yeah, I think you can't rewrite history, but I wish I'd known some of this early on in our marriage. We talked about this on the Valentine's Day episode.
Mm-hmm.
Jen's just wired for all those things you just listed.
Yeah.
And I love chaos and I like change.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, but I think we've learned how to navigate that.
Yes.
And if you know, the fallacy is if you're young and you're thinking about getting married, I'm going to marry a number that's compatible with me.
Right.
Well, I mean, to your point earlier, sixes and fours are very compatible if they're healthy.
Right. Exactly.
And
any two numbers.
Any numbers are compatible if they're healthy. Right. And if they're not healthy, it doesn't matter what number you
right.
are. So,
exactly.
I think it's, you know, when she's healthy,
mm-hmm.
she's incredibly giving and efficient mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. In her work world and, thinking about others, she's really aware of what other people need.
Yeah.
And people are drawn to that.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, and then, you know, shadow side, you'll talk about that, is that becomes just like the two, overly aware and dependent on the response sometimes. Mm-hmm. And she would say that.
Mm-hmm. They can become these hyper rule followers. They can become suspicious. They can become fearful, anxious, as we said earlier.
Yeah.
Remember with the one we talked about, the one has the inner critic, you know, that voice that's telling them it's not good enough. With the sixes, we talk about this, the six has something called the inner committee.
Yes.
And it's like, I always say this, is like there's a boardroom in the six's brain. And so when it's time to make a decision, everybody's That's talking correct. At the same time. Yeah. You know, it's just like, well, yeah, but did we think about this? Did we get this? Did we get this? And you know, again, if you're around a six, and especially if they're heightened or you're getting ready to leave for vacation and it's the last minute, the six is probably going to be that person that goes, wait a minute, did you put the water bottles in the cooler? Wait a minute, did you get our passports? Did you? But on the other hand, they're also the people that when you get to the airport, you haven't forgotten anything.
Right.
They're awesome with that. And so, again, like you were saying, even in marriage, sometimes all the questions that can come from a six, it may be coming from that inner committee, but if we'll listen to the questions, those questions are usually preparing us to go, man, we got it buttoned down. We got everything we need. You know,
no doubt.
I love that about the six. Yeah. The Enneagram seven, we call them the enthusiasts or the joyful. You say it all the time about the seven. I think it's right. Fun is kind of their favorite word. Connected to it is their basic fear, which is FOMO. You know, oh my gosh, did I miss out on some fun?
Yeah.
Sevens, they're driven by the question of, hey, where's the fun? What's next? You know, what can we go do that's really going to be good? For the seven, their foundational desire is, I just want to have it all. You know, I want to do it all. Our daughter, Sarah, is a quintessential seven. And, you know, when Sarah graduated college and, you know, the question, so what are you going to do now? I mean, it was like almost paralyzing to her. Like, what, you mean there's only one option? Because in college, I played soccer and I was in a sorority and I went to class and I had a Bible study and I had a bunch of groups of girls and I would work. And I mean, it was just like, I want to do it all.
Right.
And literally, you probably remember this, you know, when Sarah graduated, she saved her money she got from college. She worked really hard that summer. She got her little nest egg. And then, I don't know, maybe it was in August or September, she took off and spent 99 days traveling around the world by herself because there's a lot to see. There's a lot to do. And that's the stereotype of the seven. They're adventurous, fun-loving, spontaneous, imaginative. They are going to be the life of the party, usually, if they're at the party.
I think when you tag along with them, if you're another number, you tend toward another number, then when you tag along with them, if you'll let your guard down, you'll probably have a really enjoyable experience.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they see the world through that lens. And a lot of times, you know, we joke about this. You use that word a lot. Describing any experience. Oh, that was fun. This was fun. And I realized one day when we were talking, I thought, I never say that. Yeah. I have fun. Mm-hmm. My family would probably say I can be funny, but mm-hmm. I'm not fun.
Yeah. Yeah,
and sometimes I'm fun, but that's not a word people you'd use to describe me. Mm-hmm. You know, I can be enjoyable to be around or not.
Yeah,
but and I thought, man, I need to pay attention to that to my Enneagram 7 friends because they can take you on adventures.
Yeah,
that you may be apprehensive about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I would just say let it go and just give it a shot.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have some fun.
Yeah. As you know, Laura, and we'll get to the nines in a minute, but Laura's a nine. So, you know, things stay in a boundary for the most part with her, you know, not in a bad way, but just like the bandwidth isn't super wide. But you get Sarah around Laura and what Sarah as a seven brings out, because they just love being together. I mean, there's a part of Laura that comes out when she's with Sarah and Sarah's in her full blown seven mode. You're right. It's just, it's a party. It's fun. And Laura will laugh so hard.
Yeah.
It's just fun to see. There it is. It's just fun to see that plays out.
Yeah.
But like every type, the seven can go to that place of unhealth too, or that place where they're not resourceful. And again, it's the non-resourceful that sometimes helps us see this.
Let me clarify something real quickly. If you don't know anything about the Enneagram, when you say shadow side or unhealthy or unresourceful, those are all interchangeable terms in that world. Is that right?
Yes.
And
I've been around too many of the different worlds because some people will use the phrase non-resourceful, less resourceful, shadow, unhealthy.
Okay. You know, I think all those are the same though.
Yeah, they're all the same. They're when we use our strength to excess.
So what does that look like for the seven?
So for the seven, who loves to be spontaneous and fun and go do things, it starts looking like being impulsive, scattered, random. They begin to shut down and they can move to escapism and they can become then, again, like some of the other types as well, they can become somewhat superficial and just kind of live this, well, forget it kind of mentality. So again, at the extreme, that thing that was so fun becomes almost irresponsible is what the seven has to be careful with. You know, it's interesting in the Enneagram world, the seven has the highest propensity to be in the world of addiction. Now, the reality is every one of the nine types can struggle with addiction. But the seven, and it makes sense because if I'm constantly just seeking fun, if I'm constantly seeking pleasure, and part of the seven, if I'm constantly avoiding pain, bingo. I mean, that's a bad combination. But again, a healthy seven goes, I hear Sarah do this all the time. I know my tendency is to avoid pain, but I need to have this conversation. I'm going to lean into it.
And typically they're, when they do get serious or have a confrontational conversation that needs to happen, the ones that I know anyway, do it pretty well.
Yes. Yes.
They're not afraid of it. They just don't love it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because it cheats them from fun. Yeah. If we have to have a serious conversation or go have fun, well, I'm choosing fun every time.
Right.
Enneagram 8, we'll keep moving. The challenger, the powerful, the moving forward energy. We've already kind of talked a little bit about them this morning, but that really is what the 8 is. The 8, their basic desire is to protect themselves. The 8 sits in a room and they immediately are asking the question, who's in charge? I will do this.
It's usually them.
I will do this when I go into a boardroom meeting and I'm facilitating sometimes, not all times, but sometimes I'll go in. And, you know, if there's not somebody that's introducing me, if they're just telling me, hey, Jeff, just go ahead and get the meeting started when you're ready. They all know you're the guest in the room anyway. Sometimes I'll just sit there and let the chit chat happen for a long time. And that long time is usually 4 or 5 minutes. And then it's almost inevitable that it's going to be an Enneagram 8 that'll say, okay, so what are we doing here? So is it time to start? Who's in charge? It literally is that question because, again, what was your friend's mantra? Be
brief, be bright, and be gone.
I love that. I love that because that is the Enneagram 8. Eights and threes often get mistyped. They look similar because they both are efficient and effective in getting stuff done. World of difference, though. The threes getting it done out of there's task and I want to perform. And at some level, it's about I've got to have a good image as we start moving the unhealthy side. For the eights, it's just like I'm going to make a decision. I'm pushing this thing forward. Nobody's going to stop me. I've got to get this accomplished right now. And so you can hear the strengths and the weaknesses in it. You can hear the resourceful and the less resourceful side. Eights are awesome in that they're usually confident, decisive. Inspiring. We don't say this enough about the eights. Most eights are really compassionate, but because they drive so hard, sometimes we don't see the compassion. Side note, a lot of nonprofits have been started by Enneagram eights because the eight loves to champion the underdog.
There's a super sensitive side to the eight that you'll miss if you're not careful.
Yeah. Because, and especially if the eight can wax and wane and be over in that less resourceful, that shadow side at times. Because when the eight is less resourceful, they can be willful, confrontational, demanding, emotionally unaware. We call them emotional bulldozers at their worst. Because, by gosh, I'll get this done. Just get the hell out of my way. You know, that's kind of what happens in the eight when unhealthy. But when they're healthy, again, accomplishment, drivenness, decisiveness.
There is man, I'm so drawn to the eight. My personality. Mm-hmm. And I've worked for two. My daughter's an eight. She's a great hang. My son's a great hang. He came over the other night. And my daughter-in-law was sick. And I thought, he's a four. So, of course, we're similar. And like, man, he's just, everybody doesn't get this, I know. And so, but God's blessed me with two kids that I love hanging out with.
Mm-hmm. They love hanging out with you.
And so, just fun. But, I'm in the work world, my current business partner guy owns our company. Man, he's an eight. And he is, I love the guy. He's, he can be impulsive. Mm-hmm. And, but you're never in doubt about where you're going. That could change quickly, but he's usually got a good reason to change. He's very successful. But if I have a phone call with him that lasts more than 20 seconds, something's wrong.
No, exactly.
And, but he's willing. If I called him at 3 o'clock in the morning, he would answer. Yep. Or if I say, hey, I need to talk to you for 20 minutes, I need you to focus, he would do that. Yep. I mean, just incredibly available. But man, the performance, mm-hmm. we're he's got people. We're a small group, and you got to perform, or there won't be a spot for you.
Well, and think about the eight. It's almost the word is more accomplishment than performance. I'm going to nuance it this way. The three, it's about the performance. I need the crowd.
Yes.
The eight almost doesn't care if there's a crowd or not.
Right.
It's the attack.
But you always know where you stand. That's what I love about it. Is you don't have to try to. What I'm not great at, and I'm trying to be aware of with other numbers, is say where do I stand? What are you thinking? The eight, you don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. So you can just kind of be yourself, and they'll let you know.
Yep. I want to do a little asterisk here on the eights, especially for women, because I think this is something that I have a passion for. You know, you say you love Enneagram eights. I do too. I love Enneagram eight women. I love watching them work and perform, how they think, whether it's running a business or running the household. But I think there's some of our culture, and especially the world that you and I have grown up in, the church world sometimes, that we'll look at Enneagram 8 women, and it's funny, they'll do the exact same thing or say the exact same thing that the Enneagram 8 male will say, and where the 8 will be like, kudos for your strength. Man, the ugly B word can come out sometimes about the woman doing same thing. Yes, and that's so not cool. That's so not all right. I think what we've done at times is we've looked at the female eight and said, you know, you need to be more like the two, you know, and we want to put them in a box. And I just want to say, if there's women listening to us and you're an Enneagram eight, your strength is gorgeous. It's beautiful, just like any other number, but be careful. And if you find yourself in a culture that at times tries to squash that, there's conversations that need to be had. And most eights will have them. They just have to be careful not to have that then out of their less resourceful side, because if they do, then they do look like that ugly part of them. And I just think to hold and own your strength as an eight unapologetically is really important.
That was some of the best advice you gave me. Again, my daughter Caroline's an eight, and you told me one time, hey, as much as you can, just let her be big.
Yes.
And so I would encourage.
That's great.
My wife's great about that. And we've learned that over the years. We weren't always great at that.
Yeah.
Or even good.
Right.
In fact, we sucked at it for a while.
Yeah.
To be honest.
We all.
But I would just encourage you, if you think if you're parenting a daughter particularly and she's wired that way, man, I just encourage you to just let her be as big as you can let her be.
Yep.
Life has a way of calming you down anyway. I wouldn't worry about that at an earlier age.
Yep.
You know, and obviously there are parameters, but generally speaking, life and experience put the parameters in place.
I remember 40 years ago, I don't know however long it's been, when Dobson wrote his book, The Strong-Willed Child, and you know, it was all the craze, right? The older I am, the more I'm sure there's great stuff in that book. I'm not thinking I'm Mr. Know-It-All in this, but I don't like the phrase strong-willed child, because I think what we're trying to build is strong kids. And we want them to have a sense of autonomy. And I think sometimes we look at a kid and we say it almost always with disdain. Well, they're just so strong-willed.
It's never a positive.
I know. Well, so usually if a parent tells me, I have a child that's so strong-willed, I go, oh, that's great.
Awesome.
I'm so glad they're not weak.
Yeah.
You know, but especially with the Enneagram 8. That's what made me,
I think because
sidebar, but it just made me think of
no,
that.
No, yeah. I think that's a great topic, because I think when you, and I feel strongly about this, when you... So much of our identity when you're a young parent is how well your kids behave. And this is a different topic for a different day, but I'm going to get on my soapbox for 25 seconds.
Well, it's a good one. We need to get on someday,
man. God made kids to, in my opinion, to thrive. Mm-hmm. And part of thriving is learning how to be who you are and not be that way perfectly at 5 years old or 6 years old.
Yeah.
And even at 16 and 15 or 25 and 26, they're not perfect.
Yeah.
I'm 58 and I'm far from perfect and I'm learning. So I hate that phrase, the strong-willed child, because the assumption is if my kids are passive and quiet and sit quietly in church and school and never get in trouble, that, what a great parent, what a great parent. You know what, man, your kids are so good, Jeff. They said yes, sir, and no, sir, and yes, ma'am. You know, how well-behaved. They're so respectful. That's the word you get.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing wrong. Don't. You know, email me jeff@gmail.com about the yes sir, no sir BS. But anyway, point is, gosh, just try to understand your child and let them be who they are, who God's made them to be, and make some mistakes. And there are consequences for mistakes. I'm not saying that, but that this is the time to grow when they're in your home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Steve Pierce, parenting expert today. No, this is good.
Not an expert, but it just drives me. Yeah.
And you and I have talked about this so much.
And I say it drives me crazy. Together. Man, that sounds so condescending. I did it.
Oh.
And I injured my children because I wanted to be thought of as a certain way as a dad. Oh. And I listened to other voices. And especially when you get around, you know, there are always groups or families. I'm sure every couple has folks they get around, and you feel automatic pressure that your kids should perform a certain way. Mm-hmm. Man, I'd say the quicker you can kind of get rid of that, the more enjoyable your family life is going to be.
Well, if there's ever a rearview mirror topic that you and I have talked tons about that we need to talk about on these microphones someday, it is the parenting thing, because I think the passion we both share for young parents comes out of massive failures
for
that
sure
we both have talked about. God. So anyway,
we're gonna do parenting one day, and we're gonna do kids and sports one day.
Oh, that would be a blast.
So
yeah, Enneagram 9. The Enneagram 9, we call them the peacemaker, the peaceful. You know, if you've ever seen the Enneagram image, if you're new to the Enneagram, there's a circle that has these lines that run between the nine numbers, and it literally just it looks like a clock. You know, the numbers just go around the same way the clock goes. But at the very top of the Enneagram is the number 9, and it's interesting. You would think, well, wouldn't you start with the 1 at the top? When no, the 9 sits right at the top, and in many ways, that's the perfect place for the Enneagram 9 to sit, because the Enneagram 9 has this ability to see every perspective so well, because part of what's driving them, the basic desire of the Enneagram 9 is harmony and peace and stability. You know, we call them the peacemaker for a reason. The nines, they are asking the question of, you know, what's going well? How do I keep the peace in the situation? You know, they are just beautiful peacemakers, and don't see that as they're passive necessarily. Right. And unhealth, they can be. But Henry Kissinger, you know, from a previous generation, Enneagram 9, Bill Clinton, an Enneagram 9.
But strong.
And if you think about both those men, they did some stuff in the space of world peace that was incredible. Ronald Reagan, an Enneagram 9. They're not weak by any stretch of the imagination, but they're looking for harmony. They're looking for unity. When you think about the Enneagram 9, their core makeup is they're usually very receptive, reassuring. Again, harmony, cooperative. And they're generous people. They love well. Like every type, when taken to the extreme, when they get into their less resourceful sides, the nines can become complacent, passive, judgmental, stubborn. They can start acting like victims. You know, we say this about the nines. When the nines get to their place of being less resourceful or unhealthy, they fall asleep to themselves and to the world. Mm. They numb out. So the nines have this ability to be present, be engaged, and something happens that usually threatens harmony and peace. Usually it can often be conflict. And the nine literally can almost just like glaze over and pull back.
Withdraw.
I remember in our early years of marriage, Laura and I would have, there were a couple topics that were kind of recurring. And when they would come up, you know, you would see that happen in Laura. Laura, as I said earlier, is an Enneagram 9. Laura is super engaging and great relationally and conversationally. So I was used to that wife, right? But we would get to this point in certain topics. And it's like the old cartoon characters. You could see the blinds just starting to close on the eyes. She was just numbing out. I can't do this anymore. So if you're a 9, there's this beautiful part of you, peacemaker. You know, you're so receptive, reassuring. But be careful, because going to the extreme, you just begin to go and hiding.
I like what you said, though, a minute ago about the Enneagram 9 and able to see other people's opinions or other people's perspectives.
That's a great word, perspective, yeah.
Because we had dinner with some friends the other night, and a couple friends we've had for long times, and one of the wives is an Enneagram 9, and she and I, we joked because we've had some great conversations over the years, and we've had some conflict conversations that have been, we would both say they were good, they were fun, but she's great at seeing the perspective of someone else.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't always see that. So it's really something that they bring to the table that's appealing.
Yeah, yeah. So this has been fun I don't know how long we spent talking about.
Oh, we're done. You're winding it up.
Well, I'm going to, because we're doing a part 2 later. Did you have more questions?
No. Well, yeah, if I do, they're done. You're done. You've just wound us up. We can't unwind that. We can't go back and start talking about it again.
My threes kicking in, being efficient, going, okay. But here's what's in my mind, the reason I said this. I think I know how to do this. I'm going to try to post a couple of resources with this podcast.
Ooh.
If you're new to the Enneagram, there's some books that you and I have both talked about before that are great primers or introductory books to understand the Enneagram. And so if you're new to it, and what we're talking about today is interesting, I just want to point you in the direction. But
I like that.
Off the top of the head, is there anything, any book or any resource that immediately comes to you?
No, there's not. Where I've read the most is there are a couple of sites, and I won't remember them.
That's
online.
Okay. Yeah.
That,
we'll try to post those too.
Yeah. No, I don't. Okay. I don't have any resource that comes to mind.
The Suzanne Stabile book that she co-wrote with, Ian Crone, local guy. Yeah. The Road Back to You is such a great introduction to the Enneagram, and there's books that are 700 pages on the Enneagram, and this book is a quick read, but man, it's a great intro. So we'll post some content out there for those who may want to go a little bit deeper.
That's good. I've never posted any content, this is new to me, and I'm really excited about
it. Between your daughter and my daughter, we'll make it happen. Yeah. I don't know if I know how to post.
I'm gonna just ride that all day. Okay. I posted content today.
All right, well, you gotta do that.